And a very good morning to our political commentators, Stephen Mills and Bridget Morton.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you both here. And I'm just going to quickly remind myself of your declarations of interest. Bridget Morton is with the commercial law firm Franks and Ogilvie, where she's a senior consultant. She's a former senior ministerial advisor for the previous National-led government. Stephen Mills, executive director of UMR Research and former political advisor to two Labor governments. Good morning. Look, it was interesting, wasn't it? They came off the strong party conference last week. They had some announcements throughout the week, things that looked like, you know, things were happening, things were moving in this so-called year of delivery. There were some announcements to make. And then we have another stuff-up, really, a ministerial stuff-up with Chris Farfoy getting himself into an embarrassing situation. You want to start back, though, with the polls. And I'm not sure when that most recent poll came out, probably around about this time a week ago. You want to start with the polls, Stephen. What are you seeing that you want to draw attention to about this particular poll?
Well, the most recent one we have is the Colmar Brunton one, the TVNZ one, which was taken from 23rd to 27th November and was released last Monday evening. So it is a bit old, but just to remind people of the numbers in terms of its release, National was on 46, Labor on 39, Greens on 7, New Zealand First on 4, and ACT on 2, and there was very little movement from their previous poll in October. I thought there were three things to note from this. While it's only kind of one company that's showing it, it is two polls now where National, if those numbers prevailed in an election, it would be the government. Though it did require New Zealand First to stay under 5, which was obviously close. It's quite different from a YouGov poll, which came up earlier, which is more in line where our polling is, which showed the two parties much closer where they've been, and almost certainly a Labour, New Zealand First and Greens government. But our polling has also shown a sort of deterioration for the left from being a Labour and Green government, if the results applied in an election, to being New Zealand First decides yet again. Thought the second thing to note was ACT was 2% on both polls. They've only been in that position of delivering a second MP in 3 of 11 public polls released, but after about, I don't know, 5, 6, might even be longer, minded of not being in the position to deliver a second MP for National's generosity in giving them Epsom, there may be a tiny bit of hope building that finally that Epsom deal will deliver something for the right. It's always puzzled me that I think the base for the true free market right in New Zealand's about 2.5%, and probably for the sort of far left, you know, those who think secretly that it was a shame the Soviet Union didn't win the Cold War, is probably about 2% as well. But in the case of ACT, you know, Seymour has always seemed a competent leader, and it was odd that he couldn't get to that 2%, 2 to 2.5% that was their base vote. In the past, they've had to rely on sort of, you know, Preble and Hyde and their pyrotechnics to get them up to, you know, 3, 4, and even 7 at some stages. But euthanasia seems to have done the trick for them. I think that's the only plausible explanation for the ACT improvement in their vote. I mean, why didn't they go to 2.5% during the Jamie Lee Ross thing? And the third thing, just to sort of throw in, I don't think it'll happen, but I think it was interesting to note Audrey Young's column that with New Zealand First on 4% in both the recent Colmar Brunton polls, the October and November ones, there may be a case for Labor to throw Northland to New Zealand First, as it did, you know, surprisingly effectively in the 2015 by-election.
I want to come back to the some of the differences between these polls, especially now we're starting to see different methodologies. But Bridget, do you want to pick up on it first of all?
Well, I think just what's really interesting, that is the ACT vote and what's sort of happening around those small parties, because obviously in some ways that actually decides the election or the government more than the actual big parties. So I think for ACT, I don't think it is the euthanasia. I think that provided a platform for David Seymour to get a bit, you know, more media and be seen as a competent leader and policymaker. But there's no doubt that he has been the lone voice on a number of sort of issues out there that have a particular base, like freedom of speech, those sort of stereotypical far-right sort of issues, and that's where I think he's picking up perhaps an audience that he hasn't had before.
Classical liberal issues as well,
yeah,
which people
absolutely
forget was ACT's original kind of, you know,
Yeah,
shtick.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's absolutely kind of what small parties should be doing, is finding who their base is, finding those core issues and really focusing on those. And that's what he seems to be doing well.
Maybe slowly repaired the brand, though. It's a very, very slow process from where Rodney Hyde left it, you know, in ruins. So maybe it's something. I mean, it should be possible for ACT to get 2-3%, you know, given the sophisticated understanding of that kind of voter, of how MMP works, and that it's not a wasted vote because of the Epsom deal.
It's an interesting one. If you look at National's very, very solid results, certainly in the Colmar-Brunton, it has completely cannibalised anything on the centre-right, which gives it a strong and consistent base, but no mates, depending on its attitude towards New Zealand First. I'm curious about the YouGov, though, which, of course, is a famous British-based poll, which stuff has started running, and it's good to have more polls. We can start to get some kind of a sense of a critical mass. But their methodology is different. Just remind us again what's happening with the methodology, Stephen. I mean, landlines, how much can you rely on them? You're only getting a, you know, presumably a skewed cohort, at risk of a skewed cohort out of that. If you go to online, and I think they're doing a mix of online and phone polling, aren't they?
YouGov is entirely online.
Entirely online. So then are you missing out on the very same cohort that the landline is picking up? Some doing a mix of landline and mobile. Like, how are people trying to get...
Well, YouGov's changed from a mixture of robos and online to totally online, and they've done a huge exercise in Australia following the failure of the polls in the last federal election, and that's the conclusion they've come up with, that they don't want to use robo polls at all. And robo polls really only get elderly people.
That's just automatic landline calling.
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah, and you get prompted to press numbers.
But if you come away from landlines altogether, I mean, what did we learn, if anything, out of the census if you do something entirely online?
Well, I think landlines, it was just a wonderful thing to be in the industry at the time where people all had landlines and they were prepared to answer surveys, but that's not the case now. It's, you know, just very, very difficult. You know, some people still do landline polls in special circumstances, but mostly people have moved to other methodologies now.
I think always the most valuable thing about polls has always been the trend. I think this kind of prediction of, if a government was formed today, what would it look like this far out from an election, is not that valuable, but it's looking at what those trends are up and down. And because in New Zealand that we've had less and less regular polling, the introduction of YouGov, whilst it might not be, you know, as a snapshot, be completely accurate, at least we can look at the trends and see what things are impacting.
What typically happened was that polls would coalesce back when we had 4 or 5, most of the media organisations, big media organisations doing them, and doing them frequently, polls would coalesce around a week out from an election and very often pretty much be on the money. Whereas now you go into an election night with, frankly, no idea.
The two public polls were pretty close. I mean, it was a massive leap for the Colmar-Brunton poll, which had been showing Labor in front throughout the campaign and sometimes, you know, kind of quite well in front. But at the end, they were reasonably close, the two polls we had that were publicly released. But it's always interesting with the midterm polls, as, you know, I've made this point before, but there's essentially no accountability for them. I mean, there's no way you know whether they're right or not. So, you know, you've just got to have a few of them and make your judgments. And the YouGov one was quite different. They had Labor 41, National 38, Greens 8, New Zealand First 8, which seems very high. I haven't seen that in any other poll. But they also had ACT on too. So they were quite similar on the on Labor and ACT, and Greens too weren't far away, but different on National and New Zealand First.
Colmar-Brunton looks like a bit of an outlier. They tend to have their they tend to traditionally, each of the polls, favour or misfavour one party, actually for a reason I've never fully understood as well. They tend to be on the upside for one party or on the upside for another party for a different poll.
Yeah, but I mean, we saw the Prime Minister on Monday dismiss the Colmar-Brunton poll on that basis, and then I think there was a number of people that went out there and looked at the numbers and actually said that's not true. It's not one that has traditionally been negative towards Labour.
Well, it has, but you have to go back into the distant past. There has been analysis which has shown that the Colmar-Brunton poll has systematically failed in like many years ago.
To this week, and coming off the back of that conference, there was the infrastructure announcement that we discussed last week, but there were others. There was some freedom camping moves, which is the sort of itch that if you scratch, it can have a surprisingly popular impact in some areas. The cannabis legislation, we started to get some more idea about what that was going to be like for a referendum. The Pike River entry is the one I forgot as well. That's a significant tick for the pledges that Andrew Little and Labor has made. And then there was the Commerce Commission report come out that makes them look like something's going to happen on petrol prices. So there was sort of a week of announcements, and then overshadowed by the Farfoy missteps. And were they missteps? What do you make of what you saw?
Oh, there's no doubt that it was a misstep, and I think the minister acknowledged that. And it was clear that whilst, you know, he didn't actually take any action, or as far as we know, didn't take any action, it was very clear that his intent was to take action for, you know, numerous parts. I think what was particularly interesting around this was the absence of the PM around this. Obviously, she made the decision that she didn't want to demote him, but she didn't front up to media on that. And I just think that shows a really interesting sort of signal about what her role as leadership is within the cabinet, because obviously you've got, I think when your ministers do have misjudgments, you've got to come out and say that they're not okay.
Yeah.
And she didn't do that.
An interesting thing, though, is contrast that with some of what Shane Jones, who is a minister in the cabinet, but for another party, some of the stuff he's done. So just to recap, the text, a friend had lobbied him to help with a family's immigration issue. He had implied in the text that he would assist and that he would, you know, be able to fast track somehow, while subsequently taking advice and taking the appropriate steps, which is that you should refer to the local MP and that you can write a letter of support if you wish, which he didn't even do. So as far as we understand it, there were no actions taken that were inappropriate, but the communications looked like he was doing something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was a second lot of communication with the family about, you know, once he'd given the advice around approaching Matt King, the local MP. So it just showed a little bit that, you know, it unfortunately it goes to that perception that politicians are there to look after their friends. And you've got to be, I think, really careful when you've got cabinet ministers sort of doing anything that kind of steps towards that. You've got to show that that's not okay, and so strong judgment around that.
But can she discipline him more than she did and not discipline a New Zealand First Minister who, some would say, would equally have been up for some kind of sanction with some of what has occurred? She's had to kind of distance herself in some ways from a heavy-handed approach to ministerial boundary testing.
Well, I think, you know, given we've got the cabinet manual and we have got standards of behaviour that we think our ministers should be adhering to, I don't think it's good enough for the Prime Minister to say that she's not going to discipline one of her own party because she doesn't want to discipline somebody from the other party.
Well, she didn't say
that's
that.
Just, no. But I'm just saying that you're assuming that that's where she's had to maybe lower her standards or not be able to take disciplinary action where she wants to, because I think it's clear that she does want to take some action around Shane Jones, her sort of terse replies and media interviews around his actions sort of denote that. But I think that's not an excuse as to why you're the Prime Minister. You have to make hard decisions.
No, I think she's handled it well, and it's just not her style to be heavy-handed, and we shouldn't expect that. She's not going to sack ministers at the first sign of any trouble without doing a proper investigation and getting all the facts in front of her, and I think that's what she did. And that made it clear that, you know, in his own words, Chris Farfoy's been dumb and the whole thing's messy. And you can kind of understand, you know, why the media would get excited when you say, I can't put it in writing and, bro, I have a plan and things like that. But in the end, it was clear, even from the correspondence itself, from the messaging, you know, the final message from Kerrison was, I have to assume no communication means no follow-up. So he's essentially cleared by the same set of correspondence. He's on notice not to do it again. Her dissatisfaction with his performance has been made clear, and I think, you know, all that's appropriate. And I don't know, I think we're going to have a real contrast in leadership style between, you know, that kind of more collegial way of doing things and, you know, the sort of macho bluster, which I think Simon Bridges is increasingly getting into, that no matter what the issue, he says, you know, Jacinda Ardern, you know, how distant from the Prime Minister they could possibly be, can't evade responsibility, and she's got to show leadership. And by showing leadership, it seems to mean instant sacking, and I, you know, just think that's not the way she operates, and, you know, I don't know whether people would find that, you know, his kind of method of, which presumably he would follow if he's going to be consistent, of sacking ministers at the slightest sign of trouble.
I think there's a difference, though, between sacking and being accountable. So, you know, her not presenting up to media to sort of give a really strong articulation front-fronting it, I think that shows the sort of lack of accountability to the voters, which is quite different. I can't say within this circumstance the appropriate thing was a sacking. I mean, you know, politicians are people too, but I do think the fact that she wasn't strong out of the gate shows that she, you know, possibly needs to show a little bit more of that disciplinary.
Yeah, but the process to follow in that case would be to have done an exhaustive search of all emails and correspondence and interview the minister really closely, because if she went out there and said what she said now and then it turned out something had happened, you know, she'd look really foolish. So I think it was appropriate to go into a sort of semi-radio silence until all the facts were known and then act.
Yes. Let's look at a couple of the other matters to come up. And as I said, the main sort of offence, really, of Mr. Farfoy, politically speaking anyway, was to have obliterated a few days of things looking like they were happening. One thing that did happen that many people have taken exception to was the speed with which this ban on overseas donations was rushed through in a piece of legislation. Bridget.
I can only assume that the Minister of Justice knows more than what he's telling us.
There was an enormous donation looming?
Yeah, that there was something coming, because it just seems bizarre. I mean, the only other sort of theory that you can kind of come up with was that they thought that maybe taking this step would distract from more questions about what they were doing about the New Zealand First Foundation, because that is the big sort of issue around donations at the moment. This wasn't touching on this.
More attention to it rather than...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And so I don't understand. I mean, the timing of it seemed to be a little bit of a kick to the Justice Select Committee to deliver the report on the election. And so that's one thing, but putting it through on urgency just seemed completely and utterly
redundant. Well, presumably the logic is if there was some enormous infusion of funds coming to the New Zealand political system, if you left enough time it would happen. I don't even know what the laws are around when you can donate. You can donate any old time.
Well, I think theoretically it only reduced it from $1,500 to $50 anyway, so $1,500 wasn't going to decide election. I mean, I assumed that as well, and sort of, you know, kind of asked elliptically if there was some kind of security report, and of course got no answer to confirm or deny whether that was the case. But the arguments being used is they didn't want to have it in election year, that they wanted it through and they wanted to give people time to adjust, such as the Electoral Commission and so on, and the parties themselves, which have got additional kind of compliance requirements now. And if you allowed time, it did allow scope for last minute donations if, you know, you announced you're going to do it and it didn't go through until, I don't know, May, June next year.
It is an odd one when there seems to be significant issues surrounding the spirit, if not the law, of donations at the moment anyway. It seems like a strange missing of the point of what everyone is talking about right now.
It was on the work program, apparently. I was told that so it has been kind of in place for a while, so that, you know, maybe the timing came up. But yeah, it does seem odd in that sense anyway. And as I say, I don't think the argument that it distracted from the New Zealand First issues is holds any water, and I think any strategist would have worked that out, that the two issues would be linked.
The marijuana referendum, we know a bit more. We had the famous bag of oregano held up in Parliament by Paula Bennett, talking about the amount that you would be able to buy if this law were to be able to pass, to buy in one go. It is interesting watching the lining up of the referenda, Bridget, and really beginning to focus on how much this may play into the targeting of certain demographics next year.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And I think it's interesting from Labour's point of view, because obviously they will be sort of held responsible for the next year for this referendum. And you see already that, you know, it's the Minister of Justice has to, you know, defend why certain amounts and why it's 20 years of age and all those kind of things without really having any ability to actually take responsibility for it. It feels a little bit like the capital gains tax all over. They sort of handed over to a working group, had to spend 6 months defending sort of everything that what was happening around that space, and wasn't then able to articulate it. And that could eventuate here too. They spend a year defending the fact they're having this referendum. It doesn't go through, and so they get kicked by the left and the right.
And when you look at the subjects at the matter, you've got the end-of-life choice legislation, which has is now through, subject to referendum, public approval. You've got recreational marijuana use. Does this open up the market for, if not a party that doesn't exist, a movement that doesn't exist yet, to get quite organised ahead of the 2020 election? And if so, who's that going to hurt, potentially?
I think these things always hurt Labour. I mean, the impact, there's kind of things that kind of matter in terms of these. It's potential impact on turnout, which I don't think is going to be that great. I mean, there's some argument that young people will vote on the cannabis issue, but You know, I doubt that will happen. It doesn't ever seem to happen. It didn't happen in the last election. But in terms of energy and fundraising, I think the groups opposed will get behind the right rather than there'll be more money and energy on the left than it will be on the left. And the whole thing is salience that matters. It's who switches their vote on it. But even if, in it, which is not the case with cannabis, even if there's like 70 in favour and 30 against, if the 30 against consists of some voters who've changed sides, particularly on that issue, that's how it determines an election. And in the kind of pattern of this, these moral issues, prostitution, civil unions, same-sex marriage, anti-smacking, I think in every one of those, Labor's lost socially conservative supporters. In the end, the measures pass, nobody ever hears from it again, it stays in place. But in the kind of immediate election, I think it's tougher on the left, who no matter who sponsors the bill, you know, euthanasia was David Seymour, it will seem to be becoming from the left rather than the right.
Does it politically pay, does it harm Labor, does it help National, because it's got to articulate its own position? These are these have been conscious votes, of course, but they've got to articulate their own positions. They're going to have the same question and answer sheets sent to them from lobby groups, or the same kinds of publicity around them.
Yeah, it definitely distracts from the issues they want to be talking about, which for National is, you know, the economy and infrastructure and responsible government and those sort of things. So the fact the more time they spend speaking about these issues is less time they get to speak about what they want to speak about. But in some ways, I mean, Stephen is absolutely right. I think that this will hurt Labor more and the left more than it will the right. There is the possibility, and I think you can see it coming through, the new Conservative Party, them sort of rallying around the anti-abortion reforms. This gives them two other issues to kind of build a platform on and sort of get out to it and mobilise a sort of set of voters that maybe had not been mobilised before.
Thank you both of you, Stephen Mills, Bridget Morton, our political commentators today.